Welcome to Season 7 of the Follow MLE Podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Well, welcome to the first episode of Season 7. What a way to get it started. Today we have Jim Estel, the CEO of Danby, on the show. He is a lifelong entrepreneur who grew his first business from what started in the trunk of his car to more than $350 million in sales. His business success, in many ways, is the least impressive thing he's done. I originally heard about Jim from his commitment to bringing Syrian refugees to his hometown in Canada, and with a real focus on developing them into citizens that add value. But instead of focusing on anything political around the refugees, I used the time to really try and break down the habits of Jim to help you perform better at work and at home. And boy, does Jim have a ton of habits to learn and emulate. Not only does Jim feel very strongly about the importance of health, he doesn't even have a TV in his home. I mean, think about that. This episode is just filled with the habits and best practices of a extremely successful man, professional, husband, father, a bunch of things that you can begin to put into practice. My favorite quote from Jim was, "We overestimate what we can do in a day, and we underestimate what we can do in a decade." So use this episode as a way to begin thinking long term. Without further ado, here's my interesting conversation with the one and only Jim Estel. Just a quick housekeeping item. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft. Our purpose is to teach every professional how to add value to their organization in the world. Find out how we can help your organization or you individually at LearnLoft.com. Well, Jim, thanks for being on the show. It means a lot to us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Entrepreneur, Danby CEO, early stage investor, author. There's just really so much I want to cover with you. I first learned about you through the story about how you bankrolled a resettlement of over 200 Syrian refugees in Canada and how you didn't want them to go. It was one thing to bring them there. It's another thing to put them on welfare eventually. So you really kind of captivated a group of people to get behind the development of these people. And that's what originally drew me to you. And now I've just seen everything that you're doing or have done in your professional and personal life. And I've just been so impressed. So I want to kind of break this up into a couple different areas. And I want to start with your personal journey, your journey to how you got to where you are as an entrepreneur on a business standpoint. Walk us through that journey of your professional life.
Sure. So when I was in fourth year engineering at the University of Waterloo, and I wanted to design some circuit boards, I needed a computer, got a better deal if I bought two of them. So I bought two of them and sold one, and then someone else wanted one, so I bought another couple, and then they wanted a printer, and then they wanted a monitor and some software. So next thing you know, I'm buying and selling computer products. And I started this tech distribution company. The legend is it's from the trunk of my car because I lived in a university residence, and the safest place for my high-priced computer stuff was in the trunk of my car. And I grew that company to $350 million in sales over a 25-year period. So it took me a long time. I sold it to Synnex, and then I ran Synnex Canada from $800 million to $2 billion. So the book I wrote was Zero to $2 billion, the branding and the marketing behind the story. So it was basically writing the story about going zero to $2 billion. And I've also had the privilege of working in companies of basically all different sizes, zero to $2 billion. Then along the way, I've done a lot of investing, angel investing and advising and board stuff. And one of the companies I was fortunate enough to invest in was BlackBerry. And I was on the board for 13 years. So I was on the board before they were public. I left the board about 2010. And unfortunately, their star has fallen, but it was also a very good ride.
Great run. Great run while it lasted, right?
That's right. And then I retired and moved to New York and did venture capital for almost 5 years. And my father got sick, so I moved back to Canada to be a good son. and I was sitting on the board of Danby Appliances at the time. The CEO resigned from Danby Appliances. It happens to be in my where I live in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. So I said I do the CEO role at Danby Appliances, and that's what I'm doing now, making refrigerators, freezers, wine coolers, microwaves, stuff like that.
It's interesting, the journey. Did you know? I want to go back to you selling computer out of the back of your car. Did you always know you wanted to be an entrepreneur? Was that DNA? Was it taught to you early on? How did you think about that, or was it out of just pure necessity?
Well, you know, I'm not sure there was pure necessity, but it was in my DNA. So I had a previous business. When I was in high school, I painted houses, just like a lot of people painted houses. But I did have probably 20 employees working for me. And I,
that's,
you know,
not
I
a little painting business in high school.
Yeah, but that sort of gave me the taste of, I can run a business, and mm-hmm. I enjoyed it. And so that was my first taste. And then I took a few years off from serious entrepreneurship while I was in university, get my engineering degree. So I guess you could say, yes, I always wanted to own a business, always wanted to run a business. And when I was in university, I would tell people, yeah, I'm going to run a $100 million business. That was my big number. And everyone would laugh at me and say, oh, you're crazy. Go get a job. And then at some point you hit like $70 million, you say, gee, I want to do $200 million. And then when you hit, you know, $150 million, oh, well, let's do $500 million. And then, oh, let's do $1 billion. Let's do $2 billion. So that's the way my goals have always worked.
Isn't it interesting, certainly because of what you've done with the refugees, but isn't it interesting how the goals of money are never enough?
Yeah. I mean, you're like, I was not doing any of this to, I was not saying I ever chased making money. Mm-hmm. But sales, you need to keep increasing.
Right.
Because in a business, if you don't increase your sales in a business, it's very hard to drive efficiency into the business. And especially in the technology business, margins go down every year, which means your sales have to go up just to cover that. So it's a continual growth business is what I have always done and been. And I like growth business. Growth businesses are inspirational. They give people opportunity. If you work for a company that doesn't grow, you have to wait for your boss to retire or die before you can move up.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very inspirational.
How did you manage that, being in a growth business and knowing how important that was, with balancing the development of people?
Well,
because the next quarter, right? I mean, the next quarter is so important. It's more important than ever, anything, right? So I've always found it fascinating to know how CEO types or how entrepreneurs balance that need for immediate growth and the importance of developing the people internally.
So partly I would say that I, even though I was public for 10 years, I was never quarterly focused. I'm always, what are we going to do this decade? So I'm one of the things that I believe in is we overestimate what we can do in a day, and we underestimate what we can accomplish in a decade. And so I am very long-term. As far as development of people go, I believe that most people have more potential than even they think. And having a growth business gives them the opportunity to reach that potential. And the reason many people don't reach their potential is because their business isn't growing fast enough. And so they end up doing the same job and fall into, you know, some mediocrity and whatnot.
What are some of those keys that, as you think back to your career, Jim, that were critical in always having a growth business?
I mean, one of my keys to success, because I'm not smarter than anyone else, is I have very high work ethic. So I work like a dog, and I kind of enjoy it, and it's what I do. And so I work hard, and I'm busy, busy, busy. Now, that said, I have studied time management. I actually wrote a book on time management as well. And it's all about working on the right priority thing. So I could be crazy busy all day doing, you know, pointless things or emails or whatever, and not driving my business forward. So I'm very aware of what are the big chunks that I need to spend my time and resources on.
Are there any specific things that you can think of that you've done to be able to ensure you're working on the right things versus just being busy?
Well, go ahead.
You know, I was just going to say, you know, an example that comes to mind, we had an entrepreneur on named Mac Lackey, and Mac uses this thing called What Moves the Needle, okay? And Mac took out a 3x5 note card every single morning, every day of the week, not just work days, and would write down what he could do today to move the needle for the business. And that became his focus for the day. Is there anything that you did like that or in the book that you would help a young professional or professional in general to ensure they're working on the things that matter the most?
So I have a daily checklist of things that I think I should do to accomplish things. But at the top of my checklist, I actually have my three big things written there in bold letters. And I have that on a clipboard on my desk. And so it's old-fashioned paper, and I've just got those three things staring at me all the time. And when my to-do list gets too big, which it often does, I take it and hide it, essentially, and put those three big things on. I play a little bit of a game with myself. If I don't want to work on Project A, then I'm going to work on Project B or Project C. It's like, do you wear the green hat or the red hat? You don't ask your kids, do you want to wear a hat? You have to say, you know, it's cold. You're going to wear a hat. Is it the red one or the green one?
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, you know, the whole idea of even someone that has achieved so much like you, Jim, and you still have a daily list of the top three things. I mean, it's almost fascinating how many people that haven't had that kind of success have no list at all, and that you continue to do that for now, you know, 30 plus years.
Yeah, I mean, my daily checklist, it has those three things at the top, but it also has a whole bunch of other little maintenance checklist things that I need to do every day to largely to be healthy and to be productive. And it's simple things like I always do a set of push-ups when I get to the office. And I have to cross off my list, or else, you know, I mean, it's just sort of in me.
And your admin walks in and she knows exactly what you're doing, right?
Darn right. I close the door most of the time, but everybody knows now, so it's not a big deal.
No, that's cool. I mean, even something as small as that, it's just a neat routine to get you in the mode of what you're doing today.
Exactly.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. You've obviously been ridiculously successful from a financial standpoint. And when the Danby CEO position opened, it was probably the first call the board made, right? You've been there, you've done it. Let's go get a guy that's been there and done it. If you looking back in your career, what are some of those things that come to mind as to some of the things that have been consistent in your career that has helped you be successful almost at every step of the road?
Well, one of the things is I'm very big on success habits. So success habits help make you successful. I ascribe to Daniel Pink's theory that willpower is limited. So everyone says, wow, Jim, you're really disciplined. I'm not actually disciplined. I have a lot of habits. And if something's a habit, you don't think about it. So it takes no discipline for you to brush your teeth because it's a habit. It doesn't take any discipline for me to do my push-ups. It's a habit. I just do it. So I'm very, very big on habits. Aristotle said, you know, we're the product of what we repeatedly do. And I believe that. And I know a lot of your audience are young people. And when you're young, health-wise, you live on past glory because you're used to just going out for fun and playing football and hockey, and it's what you do and you're naturally active. But as you get older, start having kids, it's very easy to slip into the trap of not necessarily eating well, not necessarily working out, and we're the product of what we repeatedly do. I go to my class reunion and I can see some people perhaps repeatedly sat on the couch and drank beer instead of went for a walk. I'm a big believer in health, and that's one of the ways I keep up with my young kids.
Did I'm going to go a place now on that, and it's I've always been curious about it, is when you see people, let's say at Danby or at other prior companies that you've run, that don't have those intentional habits in place and aren't aware of them, do you do anything to try to help them develop them, or do you just simply lead by example and hope that they see what you're doing and then they would do something similar?
Also, I try to do a lot of things. My previous company, we had fitness centers, for instance, at the our offices, and we would have a yoga instructor come in. We have some of this stuff, but my experience actually is it tends to be the healthy people that avail themselves of that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tend to be the people that need it. The only tangible thing that I do is tomorrow morning the farmer's market's going to be open, and I'm going there. I'm picking up a bushel of apples instead of bringing pizza in. So I do offer always healthy choices and try to keep the food that we order instead of putting cookies out. And we do occasionally put cookies out, but you may as well put apples out.
Yeah, and I think what I was talking about was maybe going past just the health stuff, right? I mean, you clearly are motivated. Mm-hmm. You clearly are, as you mentioned, you in some ways you'd love to work. One of the biggest struggles that I've had as a leader, and certainly as other leaders that I've seen, is they look at their people and they might not see them working as hard as them or to see the same level of commitment of them. And I just was curious what your feelings were around those two subjects, or what you've done over the years as you see certain people that might not have that same level of discipline or motivation.
Well, a leader's job is to inspire, and the more inspired people are, the more engaged they are. And the opposite is the more they just have a job. And a lot of people, of course, need a job, so they come to work because they have to have the job, but they're not inspired. A great leader can figure out what sorts of things inspire someone and ideally put them in the situations they love doing. And quite often, what inspires one person doesn't inspire another. So I'm not a real accounting guy. Of course, I know how to do it, but I have people that work for me. If I go and say, I need a spreadsheet to do this, they drool and think, wow, I can't believe how good my job is. I get to spend all day on these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of slotting people in the right place. I believe in Simon Sinek's view, which is start with the why. The more people understand what their why is and what the why is of the company, the more they will be inspired. So we sell at Danby Appliance, we sell like bar fridges and freezers. And, it maybe isn't that inspirational to sell, another container of freezers, because it's just great. It's a container of freezers. What's the big deal? So one of the things that I've always done is I'm quite philanthropic, and I use the money that I make to help others. And that inspires my staff to say, wow, I want to help Jim more, and I want to help the company to be successful. Because when the company's successful, the company's more able to do more good in the world.
Mm-hmm. Were you always that way, Jim? Did you always have that servant heart? Or, a lot of people would say, well, it's easy for Jim mm-hmm. to be that way because he's made so much money, right? How do you think about that? Or when did that really start for you? Is it something your parents instilled in you early on?
I mean, I would say it was instilled by my parents early on, and I would say it's part of who I am. I will say I was not as generous when I could not afford to be as generous, and I was a normal business person that would sometimes have cash flow difficulties in my early years, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't always rolling in the money. One other habit that really served me well is I started out without any money, and I started out living a frugal life, and I have continued to live a frugal life. And that has served me well, particularly well in business, because that sort of wipes off on the people around me. And it's been particularly good in business if times get a little bit lean. It's also very good competitively speaking, because you actually don't want to buy my microwaves if they're more expensive because we have more marble in our reception area.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. What I always say is you impress people by having great products. You don't impress people by having lots of walnut.
Right. It's interesting. The this whole idea of servant leadership and giving. We just had a. I've had the great fortune of meeting a man here in Charlotte named Toussaint Romain, and he talked last week about this difference between offering and sacrifice. And I've really found it fascinating that it's easy for you now with your success to give money, but to go to your example of the refugees and what you've done, you could have just given the money and been done with it, right? But there was something else about it that made you want to truly sacrifice for these people, and I think there's an amazing lesson there for our audience, which is just giving in your abundance is one thing, but giving and sacrificing of things of your time is completely different because your time is so valuable. And so I just really commend you for truly sacrificing, particularly in that cause.
Thank you. Now, part of what I believe is your greatest impact will be made if you work within your competitive advantage. So when I sponsored the Syrian refugee families, one of my competitive advantages is I know how to run a business, and I ran it essentially like a business. So I have a director of transportation, director of food, director of housing, director of jobs, director of mentorship. Every family gets an Arabic-speaking mentor family and an English-speaking mentor family. We have checklists, you know, set up a bank account, get the health card, you know, get the dentist, blah, blah, blah. We've got scorecards every 2 weeks. Check in. Oh, do they need help with English or ESL or what's their challenges? And so it's run like a business. And I believe that anyone who can run a business with 800 employees could run a volunteer organization, which is what we have, of 800 people. So that's
so you're using your competitive advantage to make this as successful as it possibly can be.
Exactly. Another competitive advantage I have is I know everybody. It's my city here is quite small, 130,000 population. I've been a long-time business person here because you go to the Chamber of Commerce lunches and the bank dinners and Ernst & Young dinners, and you get to know all the other business people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can leverage the business community to help. And if I get someone in here who isn't appropriate to work for me, I can call one of my buddies and say, oh, can you give them a job? And I also started with the principle that success is 50 families settling well, which includes working, paying taxes, buying groceries where I buy groceries, and speaking English with some degree of integration. Failure is families that end up on welfare.
It's so interesting to me that you continue to measure it. I mean, I know you mentioned it's your competitive advantage and the business side of it, but I think it's just fascinating, Jim, that you are continuing to measure every 2 weeks how successful it's been and where people need help. I mean, it's a completely different way to look at it. And I just commend you so much. I think so often, particularly individuals, even in their business world today, they really have no way to track or measure how successful they're doing or how good of a job they're doing. And oftentimes their frontline manager isn't helping them measure it or aren't measuring the right things. And I think there's a great lesson there of your work with the Syrian refugees into the professional world, which is how well are you doing in your job?
Well, and all I did actually is an extension of what I do in business every day, and that is I have scorecards. And at like business, most scorecards come back green. If you don't have 80 or 85 or 90% of the scorecards green, you have a huge problem in your company. So most of the time, you know, everything comes back, it's all fine. But having the early warning, this one's gone yellow or this one's a red, having that, it creates a focus on it. And the larger your company, the more important it is to have some sort of scorecard. Because you don't want to wake up at the end of the month and find out, oops, we lost money because we did something or had a problem in this area. It's measured in days.
Mm-hmm.
So you want a scorecard as fast and as quickly as you can to keep the focus where it needs to be.
What do those scorecards look like? How often are they, where were they created, or how often do managers use them, et cetera?
Well, I personally developed one sort of off the balance scorecard system, but which you can read online. There's gazillions of things like that. And I combine it with a daily dashboard. So I get a dashboard every day, which has the numbers that I think are critical for me to know what our sales are, what our cash situation is, number of customer service calls. And every company will have a different dashboard, because mm-hmm. what's important in one business is not necessarily important in another. And so I get the daily, the scorecards I do every 2 weeks, which are essentially pulling out a little bit more deep information from the daily dashboard.
Interesting. So you're just using that as your dashboard to run the business or make business decisions, et cetera. But they don't go down to the individual level, or do they?
Oh, yeah. Everything rolls up from the individual
okay.
level.
Okay. Yeah, so it's each individual has a scorecard as well.
That's exactly right. So the scorecard for someone on an assembly line is different than the scorecard of someone in sales, is different than someone in marketing and whatnot. I'm also a big believer, one other process that we have in place is weekly reports. And so I like everyone to send a weekly report to their manager that says, my goals this week were blah, I accomplished this, my goals next week are whatever. A few things you should know if there's anything, you know, in the industry or stuff you notice, and things I need from you. That's the format of that. And it's a roll-up weekly report. So the salesperson sends it to the sales manager, sends it to the regional manager, sends it to the vice president of sales, sends it to the sends it to me.
Mm-hmm.
So everything rolls up. So by the time it gets up to me, I don't necessarily need to see that the $5,000 customer did this or that, but the vice president of sales will be picking off the ones that are important for me, so that my weekly, and I don't read all the
right. No, yeah, you don't have, the time would be crazy.
Yeah,
but no, it's just the accountability, right? I mean, the accountability in the organization, I think, is clear, and I think that's a really interesting point. Is no matter what size company you're in, or no matter if you're leading a team or you want to be leading a team at some point, having places to hold people accountable is absolutely paramount. And I think you've just proven this.
And it also is good to hold yourself accountable. So I actually send weekly reports to my board. So I pull off the information that's interesting and add stuff that's interesting. And I started that after I sold my first company, and I was now working for a larger company, and I was just noticing things weren't happening. So I brainstormed, how can I have more impact? How can I get more influence? So I started doing a weekly report. By doing a weekly report, all of a sudden, my bosses, which were in head office in California, said, oh, gee, I guess Jim does do something. I guess Jim does know what's going on in his market.
Well, I think the neat part about it, Jim, is now you're showing your people, whether they know you send that report or not, you're not asking them to do anything you wouldn't do yourself.
Exactly.
Which is just a key tenet of leadership. Do you consider yourself a leader? And if so, can you think to when you first thought that?
I do consider myself to be a leader, and I guess I would have thought that back even in university. I'm not sure why, and I'm not even sure why I'm a leader, but it just happened to me. So I'm not sure why.
Yeah, I've actually never asked the question. I just felt compelled by hearing your story. Well, let's get into some of the fun stuff before we close up. What are some of the things you mentioned so much? You mentioned about, you know, your escalation from very early on to where you are now and leading a big company. What advice would you give a young professional today, either graduating university or, you know, maybe 5 years into their career? Why should they care about becoming a leader?
Well, I guess I think being a leader is more fun than not. And it goes back to the what you can accomplish in a decade, you tend to underestimate. And if you work every day towards becoming better, in a decade, you will be a lot better. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if you want to be an expert in any field, if you spend an hour a day reading about it, studying it, within 6 months, you'll be an expert. Within even 3 months, you'll be an expert. You'll be miles ahead. And what does that hour a day take for you? It takes nothing. I mean, it's...
It takes turning off the TV for an hour.
It takes turning off the TV. So yeah, everyone says I have high self-discipline, and the answer is I have systems and process, and so I actually don't have a television. Television is a big time waster, in my opinion, and I also, if I had total self-discipline, I could have a television, because I would not watch it, but I know myself well enough to know if I had a television, I'd watch it.
So you have no television?
I have no television.
That is amazing. That is amazing. I've thought about taking the television out of the bedroom. I haven't thought about taking it out of the house.
Well, I'm telling you, you won't miss anything. I'm sure you're going to have computers anyways. You can watch it on the internet. And if you can't get invited to a Super Bowl party or a Grey Cup party, then you don't have enough friends.
Yeah.
And so anything that you want to get invited to, you can. There's certain things I like watching on a television. I like watching elections. I like watching some sports things. I'm not a big sports guy, but there's always something better about watching with other people.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's probably one of the more interesting things we've heard on the show. So I'm appreciative for you that you shared that. What's the best investment that Jim's ever made?
Well, I happen to have lucked out in BlackBerry, so that was the best, luckiest one. Although my first business, I started with like $5,000, so I started that with nothing. It just took me a long, long time to grow it, that's all.
So the investment of into your entrepreneurial professional journeys?
The best investment into my entrepreneurial, that is a great question.
It doesn't have to be financial. You know, sometimes we hear, you know, the investment I made in my own self-education or the investment I made in the time to find a mentor or whatever it may be. It doesn't always have to be, you know, I invested $5,000 and I had $1 million return. I'm just kind of curious, as you think back to your life, you know, what's the best investment of time or money that you've made?
So the best investment is I have looked after my health. And you can look after your health in half an hour a day. That's literally how long it takes. And as a result, I'm not in awesome shape, but I'm in good enough shape that I can beat most 30-year-olds at a foot race, or I can lift as much as many of them, and all that kind of, like, you name it. I'm in decent shape. I'm not massively bulky or anything like that, but half an hour a day invested in your body, it yields huge dividends, especially as you get old, because the biggest thing you fight is you need energy. And the way to have energy is to be in shape.
Mm-hmm. It's a great answer. What's harder, leading at home or leading at work?
Oh, leading. Well, the key is, you don't lead at home. Like, there's a different boss there. But leading at work is way easier. I mean, I've tried with my kid. When my kids were young, I wanted to get them to do something, and when they didn't, I said, don't you know who I am? It just didn't work. So it's just, I don't know what it is. For some reason, that doesn't work. And the other problem that you have at home is often your outcome is much more soft. And as entrepreneurs, we like hard outputs, like I can measure it. Mm-hmm. But you can't really measure, you know, my wife hates filling in her scorecard.
Right. And I think the fact that you even have one for could be part of the issue.
I'm teasing. I don't have one at home.
I'm just kidding.
You get the idea.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a good point. And now I think about that a lot with my kids and they're my parents, their grandparents, and to see them now really truly invest in those kids' development as kind of the middleman now, it's really fascinating and phenomenal to see, and to think that my kids have the opportunity to do that. I know you have 5 grandkids. Just leading at home, I always find to be a little harder, but I do think the investment that you make in time with those kids or the time with your grandkids will be stuff that will never be, you'll never look at that as a time poorly spent.
You're absolutely right. And leading by example is that's what will really drive it home. And kids won't listen, but they will watch.
Mm-hmm. Kids won't listen, but they will watch. It's like a good friend of mine says, Jim, he says, kids spell love T-I-M-E.
Right.
What are some leaders you look up to? If you, I often ask the question, if you could have dinner with three leaders, who would they be, living or dead?
Well, one of my favorites is Mother Teresa. I think she was one of the great leaders. And I just admire her selflessness and whatnot. And I also look up to Gandhi. I thought he was incredibly courageous to do what he did. And then I do look up to the ones that have started from modest roots and grown, like even Sam Walton. Of course, everyone likes Warren Buffett. I like his old boy style and down-to-earth way of doing things. And I often refer to the way he does things to say, look, I can't understand it. If I can't understand it, then we can't do it because it's too complicated for me.
Those are just some great examples. I love the Mother Teresa example. I think she just was an exceptional woman. Let's end on this. I've never done this, but I think with your background and your experience, it would be an interesting answer. And that is, if you had one message to send to all your employees at Danby, and for that matter, for really any professional, what advice would you give them right now?
So the advice is not what you would think. You would think I would give business advice, but the advice is more look after your health, because that's what gives you the ability to do everything else in your life. You can't accomplish anything without your health.
Well, when this is over, I'm going to get down and give you 20. How about that, Jim?
Awesome. Outstanding.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Where can people find you? Where can they find out more about Danby? What's a good place for people to go?
So Danby Appliances is www.danby.com. My blog is www.jimestill.com. And if you can't find me with Google, then you don't know how to use Google.
No, we can link people to the right places in the show notes as well. But if there's any other ways that we can help you on this journey, certainly with the refugees. I know it's a big hot button issue in America right now, and probably misunderstood more than anything. But we just, your example of leadership and your example of success, certainly business, and then also personally, I think it's worth mimicking and learning from. So we can't thank you enough for taking the time to come on the show.
Well, thank you.
Awesome, Jim. I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It's a great pleasure and honor to bring you stories and best practices to help you on your leadership journey. As always, it would mean a great deal to us if you would share this with your social networks or with your friends. The best way that you can help us is to spread our word and help us reach more people, which is our ultimate goal with this show. As always, you can follow me on social media at John G. Eads. You can give us feedback on the show, ways for we can improve. And if you'd leave a rating and review wherever you listen to the podcast, it would mean a great deal to us. We get a chance to look at every single one of them. Until next time, hope you're a great leader at home and at work.